Today I'm talking to Ben Merkel, a former Marine tank driver who is now a historian and the president of a college and has written the best book on Alfred the Great, who might be the best role model for today. Welcome to another T-Rex Talk. My name is Isaac Botkin, and with me today as a guest is Dr. Ben Merkel, who I find fascinating, and I hope that you do as well. Originally, because Dr. Merkel is the president of a college, we were going to talk about education, higher education, and educational trends. Then I thought, nah, that's boring. Let's talk about Alfred the Great, because Dr. Merkel has written a great book on Alfred the Great, and I think, Dr. Merkel, you bring a lot of both an understanding of combat and military, but also some of the other stuff that Alfred did. So I was very excited. I read a bunch of Alfred the Great books, yours, and did some more research. But then stuff has been breaking out within the halls of higher education. So now that's topical again. Would you rather talk about Alfred the Great or academia? Or is there a way that we can kind of blend lessons from the two?
Yeah, it's an interesting moment right now. I mean, the whole position of college president, the decision making that happens in these kinds of crises is really on the front page. You know, you see what's going down in Columbia, UCLA, elsewhere. It is really interesting. And I mean, the way I would connect that to Alfred the Great is right now you have the perennial temptation to pay the Danegeld, which is going on in all of our college campuses, and an inability to read the moment and understand the consequence of this, and the fact that you're choosing a path that leads to your own destruction. And that was, I think, the hard lesson that was learned by the various Anglo-Saxon kings during the Viking invasion, is that you have this invading horde who promises to pillage, rape, plunder, kill, maim, and you go out and face them in combat, in which case, if you lose, you'll be sacrificed in a gruesome way to their pagan gods. Or you can just pay them a huge sum of gold, and they'll agree to go away. But and so the temptation is always to that quick, short-term, easy peace, to just do that. But as Kipling is famous for his poem, saying that once you pay the Danegeld, you'll never get rid of the Dane. So the Danegeld is that, Geld is the Anglo-Saxon word for money, same with German today. And so Danegeld is the Dane money. You pay them as this kind of little tribute, and supposedly they'll go away. But Kipling's observation is, as soon as you've paid them, you've let them know that you're weak, you're easily, you're unprincipled, you're easily bullied, you'll give up all of your wealth. Mm-hmm. So they're just going to circle back in a short amount of time and say, yeah, now this time the price is a little bit higher. That's just the way these things go, is there is a kind of wicked mindset that knows how to constantly escalate at the point at which you're willing to constantly capitulate. Like if you won't draw that line, they're going to keep escalating. And you see that exact same tactic on these university campuses right now. I was just reading, some of the research done on the groups that are behind this, because these aren't just student, spur of the moment student protests. These are very carefully coordinated by far left ideologically oriented groups that are highly funded, organized, and are thinking through in very careful ways how to basically blow up America. And and one of the things that you notice is that they're very purposefully trying to coach the student protesters into doing things that will be violations of the law, but that will not be opposed, that will be tolerated by the administration.
Oh, yes.
You know, so yeah. That's like one of that's why there's such a focus on set up tents on the campus lawn, because that is actually illegal. You're trespassing at that point, but the university administration won't do anything about it. But once you've done that, once you've got them to say, oh, we break a law right in front of your face and we defy you and you won't do anything about it, you just paid the Danegeld. And now we're going to say, okay, so the next thing is to occupy buildings. We want to occupy buildings. Mm-hmm. And these are progressive steps to basically get to the point where the rule of law no longer exists. And these administrations are utterly powerless, compromised, and shams. And it's hard to say, you know what, I'm going to send in the cops. We're going to put people in zip ties. We're going to use some tear gas and we're going to remove this because everybody's going to be there with their iPhone and you look like this heartless, terrible bureaucrat for doing this kind of thing. But it's cowardice.
Everyone's going to talk about Kent State University.
Yeah, but it's cowardice. This is your job. You know, this is why you have this position, is to establish order on your campus. And you have to do that.
Yeah. So let's go back to Alfred the Great for a moment. Here's my thesis that I wanted to talk to you about. I believe that Alfred the Great, who's the only English monarch that is called the Great, there's lots of other the Greats throughout history, but specifically comparing Alfred the Great and Alexander the Great, Alexander the Great conquered the most territory and is the Great because of his great military conquests, and he was an incredible military man, but he personally didn't live very long, and his empire didn't last very long. He had the biggest empire for kind of the shortest amount of time. Alfred the Great had some incredible military victories against the Danes, the Viking invaders, the barbarians, but he didn't take lots of territory. He just retook what he had, the smallest amount of space in his military endeavors, but for the longest amount of time, the civilization that he built grew and flourished. And so I think that he is greater than those other the greats,
yeah,
who measured their military conquest in terms of miles and square miles rather than years of civilization and peace.
Yeah, no, I think that's really true. Alexander the Great. I'm no Greek historian, but I mean, if you look at Alexander, he really comes at this moment where you've got this massive Greek culture that is behind him, and he's riding on the end of centuries upon centuries of the building of this incredible Hellenistic culture that was pagan, problematic, and yet there's something truly impressive and glorious about the Greek civilization. Alexander the Great is riding on the tail end of that and basically pulls all that mojo together for one fantastic rampage across the world. You know, he goes on a military bender with all of that capital that has been built up. Alfred is quite the opposite, because Alfred begins from a position of zero cultural mojo. Like he does not have that. What Alfred does is he's the one who actually establishes and builds all that. He's the foundation upon which it is built.
Yeah.
And so I think of it as the difference between that great grandpa who first bought the land, established the farm, and what you know, five generations later is a massive empire because of what great grandpa did, versus the great grandson who took his family wealth and went on a 10-year spending spree. They both can point to impressive things that they owned and whatnot, but one is spending it all, one is establishing and building it all. Plus the quite obvious difference of Alfred is the culture that he's building is a distinctively Christian culture that I think has in God's providence, this is the culture that is being passed on and the West is built on.
The other interesting difference to me, obviously, Alexander is the son of Philip of Macedon. There's an expectation that he will arise to greatness and do great things. And Alfred is not the heir apparent. He's the fifth son.
Yeah.
You don't expect that the fifth son is going to become king, even at that time when, you know, mortality rates are pretty high. You don't expect your fifth son to be the only one left leading the people. And yet that is what happened. I wonder to what extent did that level of service and humility that Alfred expected to do, not being king, drive him to become a great king and a great servant leader?
Yeah. Yeah, it's he's definitely not expected to step into this position. Fifth son, you would not expect that's in the line of the throne. But it's not just that. Like, If you look at Anglo-Saxon England, to say Anglo-Saxon England is anachronistic because there was no such thing as England until you get to Alfred's grandson. Prior to this time, you've got like the Isle of Britain, that's how Romans would have referred to it, that is then settled by these various different tribes and clans, different Anglo-Saxon tribes, which then become little Anglo-Saxon nations. So Wessex is the nation that Alfred takes, but you have Mercia, you have all these different Sussex, all these different little nations. But as the Vikings come in, they begin conquering each of these nations, and the kings of each of these different Anglo-Saxon nations are either captured and executed, or they flee to Rome. And so at this time, there's a significant neighborhood in Rome that is the Anglo-Saxon quarter, and it's all of the Saxon kings that are getting out of Britain because they don't want to get executed. And so they're all relocating. So when you start, you've got a dozen or so different Anglo-Saxon kings, and you've got Alfred as number five in one Anglo-Saxon king's, you know, line of sons. So the notion that this is the guy who's going to be over England is just bizarre. Nobody would see that coming. But by the end of Alfred's life, all of the Anglo-Saxon kings have either fled or died. He's the last king, and he's the last of his brothers. He's the one man that has to stand. But the other thing that I think is important to note is the way the nature of the Anglo-Saxon court and the way they understood political rule and the way they went to battle, it was quite important that the king himself had to take the lead. So the Anglo-Saxon battle was not a battle where the king sat in the back and gave orders for how to, you know, deploy the troops. In an Anglo-Saxon society, I always think of this as the connection between the shield wall and the mead hall. Basically, the mead hall is that mead hall where all the men gather together. They feast and they sit, not with the king up on a throne, but they sit on benches all around. He sits shoulder to shoulder with his men. And during that time, the expectation is that the king gives gifts to his men. Probably the premier Anglo-Saxon term to describe an Anglo-Saxon king or lord is to refer to him as a ring giver. They're always just called the ring giver. Read Beowulf. He's always the ring giver. So his job is to give gifts. Rings are the most common, but then the next most common would probably be armor and weapons. And you give all these gifts to your men, and a great king is known by his generosity in the way he's constantly giving all these gifts away. His wife is her job is to have, you know, one of those big ox horn that is gilded with gold all around and drawings and whatnot, filled with mead. And she goes and she pours it for each of the men. And a wise queen, what she's doing is she is pouring the mead and you know, passing off the gifts of the king. The thing that she's supposed to be doing is eliciting the vows from the men. And the vow is, I receive all these gifts and this generosity from you. And in return, I swear that when the day comes and you go to battle, I will stand shoulder to shoulder with you. I'll stand there with you. And so that's the mead hall. So then you go to the shield wall, which is, like I said, not the king at a distance commanding different troops. It's everybody like in a rugby scrum moving forward, and the king has to be in there with them. He's with them, and they move forward into battle like that. If the king and the standing shoulder to shoulder with the king in the battle is the making good of the vow that you made back in the mead hall. When a man who's standing there and then turns and runs because of cowardice is not just a coward, he's betraying the vows that he made in the mead hall. Mm. See this all the angles
back and exposing.
What's that?
Yeah, and he's exposing his brothers.
Oh, yeah.
He's no longer protecting the men on the sides.
When a man pulls himself out of the shield wall, it rips it open, and it exposes it, makes it vulnerable. And you'll see this in all of the like the Anglo-Saxon poems about the various battles, where it'll describe like anybody who turned and ran, they were betraying the vows that they had made in the mead hall, and they were worthless. And they'll name their names in the poems, like These are the sons of Oda that turned and ran from the bottle molded. These are the guys that are a real problem. But the thing that's striking is how it all works because they're vowed to the king. And in order for that vow to hold, the king has to be there. If the king turned and ran, or if the king said, I'm not willing to go to the battle, there's no point in the lords going out without him. Because they're tied with him via this vow, and so they'll go with him. But if he doesn't go, they won't go. All of that is to say, when all of the kings, Anglo-Saxon kings, die off, and all of the brothers die off, and it's Alfred alone, it's not just that he has the courage to stand up when nobody else will. It's he's the only one left that has the authority to say, I am your ring giver, and I will go, you come with me. If Alfred had not stood up, there's no other natural leader to actually establish a defense against the Vikings. And so he's rising to an expectation that is put upon him, and he's the only one left in Anglo-Saxon England that can stand like that.
Yeah. Now, was he at a disadvantage? Because not being the eldest son or the second born, he had minimal military training. His expectation was quite different. Did that put him at a disadvantage, or was it he also was a very fast learner, as we can see later on in his career and his reign. But how much did he just require the sheer moral courage? And how much did he have to really master the martial virtues of being a king who leads into combat, not just directs?
Yeah. Yeah, you know, that's a really good question. I don't know that I have enough, primary sources to say, here's what he was wrestling with. I think we see that you get the impression from the various accounts from him that he's a little bit, mama's boy is the wrong way to say it, but he's definitely favored by his mother, who is pushing him poetry and teaching, she's teaching him a certain kind of world. I don't know if she expected him to go into the priesthood or something like that, but he was not being groomed for the throne, that's for sure. We do see, though, that one of his personal deep passions is hunting. He loves to hunt. And I suspect that probably gave him a childhood and an early education that was able to transition relatively quickly. It translated. But he has to pick up a lot really fast. But when you look at not just his military conquest, but everything else that he builds, as you said, he's clearly somebody who's able to read the room, understand what is needed, and then rise to it very quickly.
Now, you have an interesting career path as well. You started military, and then you went into studying history, writing books, and now president of a college. That seems like not super common. It seems like in modern times, we tend to put people into specific lanes, and these are not lanes that necessarily cross over quite as much. Now, you were in the Marines, so the Marines do study history and read more than other branches do. So maybe that's a little, maybe that was a little bit of a head start, but tell me a little bit about that journey for you.
Sure, yeah. I mean, in one sense, there's a group inside the Marine Corps that actually probably does lean into higher learning far more. But then there are large swaths of the Marine Corps that I think lean into it far, far less. So I was enlisted. I was a reservist. I served on a tank crew when it first went. I was on M60 and then transitioned to the M1A1 in, I think, 91 is when we got those. So I joined the Marine Corps right out of high school doing my plan was just to do the standard, get the GI Bill, have it pay for college. But it would, it introduced a little bit of adventure into my life. I was, skinny, non-athletic kid from Boise, Idaho, who had seen no adventure. And I just wanted something that would scare me, So I thought, Marine Corps boot camp has all the potential for that. It's funny because I I joke that, you know, like the Marine Corps gave me a lot more than I ever gave the Marine Corps. I was pretty as low on the totem pole as you can get. People always talk to me about, like, you know, how does the Marine Corps think about these things, or what's their strategy here, or were you involved with this? And I'm always like, I was the guy at the back who was just like hauling, carrying things. You know, I didn't rate a whole lot, but I sure got a lot out of the Marine Corps. That's for sure. I learned so much, and disproportionate amount of my life stories are all from my brief time during those years. So I did the Marine Corps in order to pay for college. I came up to University of Idaho, had a real sort of faith awakening in my first couple of years at U of I. But originally, I had a very strong bias towards math, science, STEM. If it wasn't numbers or formulas, it wasn't real in my mind. I thought liberal arts was just ridiculously effeminate, and I didn't really want to have anything to do with it. But what I noticed was, as I matured as a Christian, that the men that I kept seeing who stood out as the guys I wanted to be like, disproportionately had given themselves to the life of the mind and to study, particularly as I became theologically reformed. There was an evangelical kind of awakening I think I first had, but then that desire to serve God became oriented as I became theologically reformed. And reformed theology, well, it sharpens the life of the mind. It makes you say, okay, let's think really seriously about this. And I began taking reading and those sorts of things far more seriously. And I eventually ended up, initially I was doing, campus evangelism, the University of Idaho, when I first graduated. So, trying to do Bible studies and things like that. And a guy that I was lifting weights with, said he wanted us to use the U of I gym, but I couldn't because I wasn't a student. So in order to be a student, I needed to take a class. I signed up for some class. I don't remember what it was, but somebody in a Bible study I was leading said, you should drop that class and take this class on Chaucer with me. And I remember just saying, that just sounds like the lamest, most effeminate thing, like a 14th century poet named Chaucer. And he said, well, no, take this class and we'll sit at the back and make fun of the English majors together. And I was like, that actually sounds like a noble calling. I could do that. So I signed up for this class on Chaucer, and I show up, and it was a spring semester. So it's like January, which in North Idaho means blizzard of snow outside. The prof comes in, and he was former Army Airborne, and he comes in with like cut off jean shorts, a t-shirt, swearing and lighting that class up, throwing people out. It was the most intense, like, whoa. And we're reading Chaucer. And I was like, okay, hang on. This is kind of cool. And I had an opening in my mind to, like, I want to take seriously the life of the mind. But here was a guy who was doing it in this uniquely masculine way. And he was kind of Jack Catholic. So not super faithful, but had enough of an appreciation for the role of the gospel in the creation of Western culture. And what I found was, I'm sitting in these classes with a bunch of like liberal English majors, but we're working through 14th, 15th, 16th century poetry, where they're wrestling with Wycliffe, with the Protestant Reformation, with all these things. And I'm finding that in this class, we are getting closer to the heart of the gospel in these discussions, and getting to individual students' souls and like what's actually going on inside, way more than I was doing in any of my evangelism with my gospel tracts. And I found that life, I basically, as I started to move into that world, I started teaching at New St. Andrews. I started taking more and more graduate classes in literature. And I found that I was actually able to have a far more dramatic effect on students in mentoring them, discipling them, and pointing them towards Christ than I did in almost any area of my life. So I had wanted to be a minister, but I found that being a college professor was far more fruitful. And it's actually, that's the guy that got me into Alfred. We did 1 year, we did a whole semester of Anglo-Saxon grammar. And then the second semester we read Beowulf in the Anglo-Saxon. And then, so for my thesis, I was trying to find something that would connect Alfred to, or something that would connect Anglo-Saxon to some of the other work I was doing. By now I'm teaching at New St. Andrews and I was teaching a lot of Augustine. And I found out that Alfred had translated Augustine's soliloquies from the Latin into the Anglo-Saxon. And there wasn't really a good translation of his work. So I did I translated Alfred's soliloquies from the Latin from the Anglo-Saxon into modern English and did a commentary. So that was my thesis. And then when I graduated, then I got the opportunity to write the book on Alfred, mm-hmm. having just come off of spending a bunch of time on him.
Yeah. And that's, I wanted to kind of get to this idea here as well. So you are in some ways like Alfred in that you have moved from, you know, one particular lane to another particular lane because you saw the needs that were there. And I see that in Alfred's life as well. In some ways, he strikes me as the quintessential, the definitive Renaissance man.
Yeah.
I love the concept of the Renaissance man, but I kind of hate the term because Alfred is the Renaissance man centuries before the actual Renaissance. And the best Renaissance men that you can think of don't come out of the Renaissance or come out of Italy. You know, Leonardo da Vinci is kind of the exception that proves the rule. He's not the norm. But Alfred was amazing that he would rise to these occasions, read the room, see the needs, and do the things. If it was writing songs because people needed songs, he would write songs. If it was translating stuff because they needed an anchor for their civilization, he would translate stuff. If it was city planning, if it was boat building, if it was inventing, if it was demonstrating a level of, I don't even know the right term for it, but the way that he conquered his enemies on the battlefield and then ministered to them.
Yeah.
It is a fascinating difference from the previous Anglo-Saxon and Danish Viking way of completely obliterating your enemies and humiliating them. He was so fascinating in his ability to find the need and then really fill it so that what came out of his action was something that took root.
Yeah.
And bore fruit.
Yeah. Yeah. I think the thing that's so astonishing about him that's most remarkable is his ability to sit in a land that has been devastated and to see these eight things need to be built here. And they are, you know, so you've been overrun by Vikings. It's not surprising that he overhauls the Saxon military, the army. It's not surprising that from there he goes to the infrastructure of the cities, that he basically relays out all of Wessex such that an army can quickly get to defend in one place or another, that he becomes a master of city planning in order to ensure that these burgs, the fortresses that he builds, can be quickly and easily defended, so that to this day, if you go to an English city that was originally planned by Alfred, you can still see the fingerprint of his work on that city and you know, the high street that bisects the city so the army can move from one side to the other, the wall street that surrounds it, the cross streets that allow for quick, you know, defense. It's all set up in this really mastermind kind of way. That much is not too surprising. What gets really surprising is him then saying, actually, for all of this to work, we actually need a literary renaissance, that we need to teach everybody to read Anglo-Saxon. We need to teach select people how to read in Latin. We need to commission a bunch of people to start translating Latin text to Anglo-Saxon and have this whole literary renaissance. So to this day, if you take an Anglo-Saxon class, you're probably going to learn the Wessex dialect. There's dozens of dialects, but you'll just learn the Wessex dialect because that's the most common. Not because more people spoke it, but because all the books came out of that little place. That's where all the translations happen. That's where a disproportionate amount of the texts come out. So the dialect of Wessex becomes the most prominent one. But then what's even more surprising, I think, is at the foundation of it all, Alfred says the entire problem, our military problem, our political problem, our logistical problem, all of these things stem fundamentally from our walking away from the serving the true God. I mean, he's very clear that he believes the reason the Vikings were able to conquer Anglo-Saxon England was because the impiety of the Anglo-Saxon people, and that if they were to return to God in true worship, that God would deliver them. And so at the foundation of it all, that's really the thing that he's doing, is he's saying we have to serve the one true God. And so a lot of that translation project is about equipping ministers to preach the gospel and raise up a faithful nation all around them. The other thing he's probably most known for is Alfred rewrites the entire, well, he writes an entire Anglo-Saxon law, legal code, starting with the Ten Commandments. He starts with the law of the one true God, and then he establishes this legal code built upon it. And that legal code is still seen as the foundation for the common law tradition, which is the legal tradition that takes you from Alfred's Wessex up to the Magna Carta, up to the American Declaration of Independence and the Constitution. You've got this legal code that has created the world that we know of as the West. That is our legal foundation. It's the thing that we're, that rule of law, that's what is crumbling on our university campuses right now. But that all goes back to Alfred, and it goes back to Alfred's understanding that we have to serve God. And then he establishes all that. And so much that's happened in the West all comes as the downstream implications of what he did there.
It's fascinating. So looking at England today and the United Kingdom in general, things are not great. There's a lot of economic issues. Crime is high. Things are kind of disintegrating over there. And there's plenty of places you can look at here in the States that have that, similar flavor to them. But how long we still have English common law, even here in the States? We still have all these foundations that Alfred put into place. But how long was the trajectory? How many hundreds of years were people faithful after Alfred to continue to build before they started coasting, would you say? And I know that it's a nation. It's hard to put a specific number on it, but.
Yeah, that's an interesting question. I mean, with Anglo-Saxon England, you have until 1066, and you have the Norman conquest. So Anglo-Saxon England no longer exists after that. But it is, it's in one sense, though, the Norman conquest is because you already had what was going on in under Alfred had already been going on in France under Charlemagne. There are these things flow together such that the Norman conquest, though it's the end of Anglo-Saxon England, still so much of Anglo-Saxon England actually perseveres through that. You have a change of the language as a medieval French is kind of brought over, and Anglo-Saxon blends with medieval French so that you get what is Middle English. But the I don't know if you ever heard this, the thing that's really interesting is when Norman and Saxon societies blend, there's actually very few Normans that come over. It's just that they're the aristocracy. So you have this nobility that is now Norman, and then this Anglo-Saxon peasantry. And so you can still see it in our
language. Robin Hood, of course,
What's that?
And then Robin Hood, of course, one of the few Anglo-Saxon lords who's left, yes.
Yeah. But you can still see that that element of the society in our language now. So when you refer to food, you'll notice that when you refer to the animal, you'll use the Anglo-Saxon word, pig, cow, sheep. Those are all Anglo-Saxon words. When you refer to the dish on your table, you use French words. Cow is Anglo-Saxon. Beef is French. Pig is Anglo-Saxon. Pork is French. Sheep, Anglo-Saxon. Mutton, French. So basically, those that got to sit and eat it were the French. Those that had to work with the live animal, those were the Anglo-Saxons. But so you have that society kind of it goes on, and I think it still is building on what Alfred did. Like I said, the Magna Carta really is built on the foundation of Alfred's law code, but the Magna Carta is post Norman conquest, and so they're still building it. Really, in the 16th and into the 17th century, you have the true codification of the common law tradition with guys like Blackstone. Matthew Hale is another major character. Matthew Hale is New St. Andrews just started 2 years ago, the Hale Institute, which is aimed at the recovery of the common law tradition, and it's named after Matthew Hale. So he's a big character in this. And it's really interesting because in the 16th and 17th century, these guys that are doing the work that culminates in the real codification of the common law tradition, they're all coming right out of the Protestant Reformation. Some of the guys that are some of the most important and best minds in the Protestant Reformation, guys like Franciscus Junius, they're great reformers, but they're also doing the work that is the foundation for this common law tradition. And that really holds, it shapes English society, and it is the foundation for the American War for Independence, for the Constitution. All of that is like the culmination of that intellectual tradition. I would say it's basically early 20th century America, where you have that birth of progressivism, the birth of the administrative state that is no longer inside of actually this original constitutional government that we created, and it's formed in order to sidestep the principles of the government that we have created. So I would put it, early 20th century in America, at least, the launch of progressivism, the administrative state, and all of that.
Mm. So now, as the Danes are not just at the gates, but inside of some of the institutions, the Dane Guild has been paid for a long time. What would you recommend? This is easy. I was going to say, what do you recommend that the listeners of this podcast do? But you have a college full of students that you are training. So what you recommend that people do, you are teaching and directing and inspiring and educating, just as T-Rex wants to do. So you should probably have a well thought out answer for this.
I guess I should. I probably should. Yes. So, connecting it to Alfred, I think one of the things that, as we've already identified, the thing that stands out about him is the fact that he's coming to this position at a moment when everybody has been slaughtered or fled. But he leans into the moment, and he leans into the moment not just with military tactics, but with larger cultural institution building moves. And that's the thing that I think really strikes me right now, is how much evangelical Christians, I think, have quitting in our bones way too much. We flee and we abandon and we divide. And the thing that I don't see evangelical Christians being able to do is actually being able to launch, build, lead institutions, to recapture institutions. I think that it's almost become this virtue for us, I think, to leave something, to say, oh, well, it's lost, and to leave. And when I'm sitting here at New St. Andrews, what I see is, first of all, the constant pressure when you're leading an institution like this, the constant pressure to capitulate, to compromise, to whatever. It takes so much work to keep an institution pointed in the right direction. There are new temptations and new compromises pop up daily that you have to see it coming, and you have to have the spine to say, we won't do that. And that's really, really hard. But that's a skill that we need thousands of evangelical leaders to learn how to do, because there are so many churches, there are so many Christian schools, there are so many Christian colleges, there are so many Christian institutions that we have slowly just walked away from. We don't know how to fight, and we don't know how to hold ground. I would like to be in that Alfred position of saying, no further. From now on, we're moving forward and we're retaking. In 2020, when between the George Floyd and all of that, and then the COVID moment, I was shocked during COVID to see how quickly all of these platforms that we thought we were okay to work on were suddenly really, really flipped against us and became like, if you want to be on here, you have to, you know, burn the pinch of incense. You have to comply. And you suddenly realized, where are all the platforms that Christians have built that I could be safe here? I mean, how many people got nervous about their banking, about their, about whether they could, their debit cards would run for their business anymore if they weren't, you know, your CRM, if are you going to lose your CRM because, you don't, say the right things about GLBT, whatever. There are so many platforms that suddenly you either lost or we found that they were sort of, your hold here is very tentative. And it made me step back and go, like, for the last 100 years, what have Christians been doing? Why haven't we built these things? Why aren't we the ones that are in charge of this so that we can't be deplatformed at this moment? I think we need to advance. And it's not just churches. It's like, who is building the web platform that we can all be safe on? Who is building the banking institutions that we can all do business with and invest with? Who is there's a whole element of Christendom that I think has been abandoned and we need to be moving forward. Mm-hmm. So for me, when I'm looking at New St. Andrews students, I want to be graduating the leaders who are going to build those things.
Mm, yeah. Well, it's interesting. In some ways, the gun industry is even just a few steps ahead. Like, a lot of gun companies were deplatformed from Salesforce and kicked off of various credit card processing. You know, we have been banned from a bunch of different platforms.
Yeah.
And a lot of that was happening pre-2020. So this is a good opportunity, I think, for some of the folks who were a little ahead of the curve and have valued resiliency of platforms, say, over the accessibility of platforms. I think there's a lot of great lessons from across I would say commercial endeavors, but also cultural institutions and so forth. I think that there is time for uniting the clans, so to speak, to build some of these resiliencies and take back some of these, you know, it's not even a position of power, like with Alfred.
Yeah.
It was just taking back the land that produced the food that kept the people alive. It wasn't military conquest. It was just home, you know, being in control of your own home again, as opposed to Alexander, say.
Well, I don't know if you saw, I think it was 2 weeks ago that we had Richard Dawkins come out and say, I'm a cultural Christian. I want to live in a Christian nation. And what he's doing is he's looking around and he's seeing what happens when this foundation crumbles and suddenly realizing that it's not, we're not a bunch of Ayatollahs. Like, the blessing of Christendom overflows into the world and makes it possible, because Christianity is true and because the God we worship is the true God and he's the God who actually created this world. That means that the law that we want to establish and the society and the culture we want to establish is a law and a society that is in tune with human nature itself. Like, a person, even if they are not a Christian, is living in a freer society and living in a place where they can prosper more than anywhere else in the world when they're living inside a Christian nation. It is a blessing to even the unbelieving world when we make this place a thriving nation, when you have a free market in which people can compete according to righteousness, then even the unbeliever is blessed by that. And I think that when we see the alternatives of what would it look like if you have an Islamic Sharia law imposition, you're suddenly, a lot of people are going, actually, I think I want Christendom. When we look at like what the progressive just destruction and flattening of everything is trying to get to, people looking at that going, I think I'll take Ronald Reagan and Christendom and all, you know, I'm happy with that world.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, Richard Dawkins has always hated the tree of Christendom, but he's always loved the fruit. But I think that it's only recently that he's realized, as the leaves have been coming off the tree, it's only now that he's realized, like, actually, you know, I thought I could get the fruit somewhere else, but I enjoyed the shade of those leaves protecting me from from stuff. And now that the leaves are gone, like, hang on. Yeah. So that's, it's a very interesting time that we live in. I would love to see us rebuild some institutions before we get to the level where Alfred started.
Yeah. We have a lot of work to do, but I would say we're nowhere near where he was. And we have so much of the wealth all around us now. And I also think, you know, you may have seen one of our students, one of our graduates he was on Tucker Carlson describing, interacting with an article he wrote called The Vibe Shift, where he was describing how there's currently a vibe shift. There's something that's going on. And I think people are starting to stick their head up and realize, actually, we see the cliff that they're trying to drive us off. We don't want to go there. And we're starting to see actually the true north that we've abandoned. And there's a willingness to turn right now. I think this is a time for us to be as aggressive as we can in advancing our institutions. And I think making sure that we're leaning into true biblical righteousness in our culture building, that we're learning how to do this right, not for fleshly worldly gain, but for the actual glory of God.
Yeah, and not as a reactionary move, even though there's lots to react against, but trying to build those solid foundations that can continue to be built on, putting down roots that will support a lot. And then, yeah, as you said before, making sure that people can flourish inside of these institutions, inside of this culture, that it does, in fact, bear fruit.
Yeah. No, I think that's true.
Yeah. Well, I'm excited. I love your story. I want to thank you for coming on the show and talking to T-Rex folks. I think your story is fascinating. I've enjoyed every time that we've had an opportunity to talk. And I really appreciate your book, which I don't think I've mentioned the name up until now, but it is The White Horse King. And you wrote this book in 2009, I believe.
That sounds right. It was while I was doing my doctorate at Oxford that I got the book deal. Originally, it was with Thomas Nelson, and it was an amazing, it funded a whole year of study at Oxford, which was great. So it was kind of like a little, my side job for that year was writing that book. And we were there in England with five kids. So basically for one whole year, we were homeschooling our kids. And for that whole year, we got to just basically drive and go and visit and see all the Alfred sites while I was slowly researching and writing. So it came out the following year, and then actually just in the last few months, Canon Press just dropped an audio version of that. So if you would prefer an audio book, you think you need a Canon Plus subscription, but it's on there. It's not read by me. It's read by another guy, but his voice is much more fun to listen to than mine.
Well, I highly recommend the book. And then if people want to get deeper into learning about Alfred the Great, do you like Justin Pollard's book?
Yeah.
The Man Who Made England.
Yeah,
I'm glad that you said that. I like it too, but I was going to defer to your opinion.
His is good. There's another one by I'm blanking on the name of the guy. He was a prof at the Naval Academy at the time that I thought was his was the best, very academic and scholarly version. And I'm ashamed that I can't remember the name right now. I'm looking at my Alfred the Great books right here, seeing if I can identify really quick. There's one book by a guy named Alfred Smythe, who it's probably the most in-depth in terms of citing all of the all of the primary sources. So for like you really want to geek out on it, Smythe's book is really good. But Smythe is the quintessential academic, and there are so many guys like that who drives me nuts. Where I think Smythe, maybe his name is Alfred Smythe, and I think maybe he has a chip on his shoulder for being named Alfred, and maybe got screwed up too many times as a kid for being named Alfred. But like his whole thing is about trying to demystify Alfred. And so the fact that Alfred is Alfred the Great has put a massive chip on the shoulder of every academic trying to interact with him. They take every ambiguity and try to read it in the most pessimistic light possible. because they want to yes. demystify Alfred the Great. I very deliberately took the exact opposite angle and said, listen, I think that we need to put him forward at his best. And I think that, and I write, I'm capable of working in the academic space. I can do that. But I think I'm best when I'm writing at the popular level. And so I definitely am writing at a popular level here. I'm not trying to be an academic with this book. If somebody's expecting an academic text, that's not what this is. It's a popular level. Yeah. I'm trying to take all the information we have about Alfred and set him forward in his best possible light.
And I love that because there is a trend. It's not just amongst certain academics, but I think even some of the biographers writing at the popular level and historians who write more popular stuff, there is this extremely pessimistic read on the past.
Yeah.
And I believe that the only reason that it can, you know, that you would take this as an agenda is to try to, you know, make the current trajectory of the world look good in comparison. This idea of progressivism, naturally, order coming out of chaos, naturally, the dark ages have to be really dark. Yeah. Alfred has to be not so great. Everything has to be toned down so that things can look good in comparison. Even the original Star Wars movies have to be lame so that the new ones can look good. It's the only way that the comparison works.
Well, Alfred is your quintessential WASP. I mean, the only thing he isn't is Protestant, and he would have been had he been around for the Reformation. He is a white Anglo-Saxon. If somebody needs to be taken down by the progressive agenda, he's at the very center of what they're doing. And that's why I'm really happy to just kind of lean into, embrace all of the glory around him. And I think the other thing you see right now is in popular media now, lots of interest in Vikings, right? Lots of shows about Vikings, and they make them glorious and all these things. It's like, no, if you read the actual Viking accounts, this is nothing like what they were. Like, the Vikings are like these like Hell's Angel road warriors who are also feminists, you know? And it's just not what they were like at all. Yeah. I did just remember Richard Abels is the author of the biography.
Yes.
And from a scholarly perspective, I think that's probably the best one that's out there. He was a Naval Academy prof. But Richard Abels and then Alfred Smythe would probably be my number two. I'm probably out of date because I wrote this in 2008 and 2009. So it may be there's a lot of stuff that you would read now, but those were the ones that I was most drawing from.
Well, there are definitely new archaeological finds and some new tools, but generally, in my very limited experience, and you know I'm not an academician, and in fact, I'm kind of aggressively blue-collar. We've talked about this a little bit in the past. but my limited exposure is that the newer research is almost always tinged. You know, they may find new facts, but it's always tinged with stuff. There's more bones to spit out and less meat. Every time I read a new history book on a subject that I'd already studied old history books on, there's just more bones to spit out and less meat in general. So I like the old stuff. Anytime that there's new data, it's always fascinating to see. But I always come away with it with a great deal more appreciation for older scholars, Daubigny, some of these great historians and writers, Schaff, et cetera. Well, I want to thank you, Dr. Merkel, for spending so much time with us. And I love the way that you have connected together so many different things. You are a Renaissance man yourself, the way that you have seen needs and gone to meet them, the way that you have tried to communicate and elevate some of these things of the past that are getting forgotten, and then continue to do that same work. I appreciate it tremendously, and I'm so glad that you're out there. I'm also glad that you're doing this at an academic and institutional level where I don't fit. I'm glad that you're there. I love the division of labor.
Well, thanks very much. Thanks for having me.